Okay, thank you. First, I have to solve the problem of getting down the screen. You must know that. So on my way from Washington via Slack to Caltech, I can stop here. Ah, yeah. And as David just said, there is a deep problem related to the masses of quarks and leptons. In fact, it's probably the most pressing problem we have in our field, and if that is solved, we may come close to an end of particle physics. I just noticed I did something which actually one shouldn't supposed to do. One should not talk about problems in a title, but if you do that, then immediately you get the impression that the thing is not really solved, but you already said there is a mystery. What I like to do is to try to convince you, also based on the also recent experimental work going on in Japan and also in Slack and in Germany and so on, that perhaps we are seeing a little bit light at the horizon and to see at least some sort of resolution of this problem. First, I'd like to, in a sort of general introduction, like to make clear to you, everybody knows that the evolution of the concept of mass in especially what we understand as mass in terms of high energy physics or particle physics, is directly linked with the evolution of physics. I mean, I don't think there's any notion in physics which was so much modified during the evolution of our field as with respect to the concept of mass, which was born in a way by Johannes Kepler and later on by Newton. And it marched through the fields of physics from classical mechanics, Einstein's relativity, all the way to quantum mechanics and quantum field theory. Let me also, in context of that, I was wondering at some point where the expression is coming from, the word mass. And I'll give you a little bit of a historical description how it came. The word mass, which we understand today, actually doesn't come from Latin, as many people think. It comes from the later version of Latin, which is called Vulgata. It's this sort of vulgarized version of Latin, which was spoken in the 4th century in Italy. And that is where it came from. It's the expression massa, which is some sort of a previous version of pasta. And that, as people claim, we are very sure about that, is related to the Greek matzah, which is some sort of downgraded bread or cake, barley cake, for example. And that, again, is coming from matzah, which is known to most of you from the Hebrew version. And now people claim, my friend Mira Gelman claims this is wrong, but other people say it's right, that this word is coming from the Assyrian word of maku. And and here, essentially, it ends in the darkness of the history. But it's interesting that the Assyrians associated the word mako, mass in our modern language, with something extended in space. And that's I'd like to point this out. It is purely an accident, of course, but we know that David was just saying there is a mystery of mass, but one thing one has solved in high energy physics in the last 30 years, namely, I would say a rather complete understanding of most of the mass which we see in the universe, which is, after all, nuclear mass. In other words, the mass of the nucleon. And that is related to QCD. And that is, again, related to something extended. And on the other hand, we have this problem of masses, in particular for the electron, for example. The electron seems to be point-like, and still it has a mass, which is sort of, some people say this is a contradiction in itself, but we don't know, really. Let me also still point out something which is that should be known to everyone, but the aspect of mass, the concept of mass, is directly linked, as you know, to gravity and to the principle of equivalence and to the fact that, as Einstein has realized, that the inertial mass and the gravity mass are equal to incredible precision. Well, Einstein used this fact for building up general relativity, as you know. But in an accelerating system of reference or in a gravity field, both the masses react in the same way. And from the old Edwards experiments, this equality was measured to be valid up to 10⁻⁹, which is already an amazing number. But people are thinking about it, and Los Alamos is bringing it down to 10⁻¹. So it seems, as far as we can see, that the masses act as far as gravity is concerned or inertia is concerned in the same way, which a little bit is surprising when you look at it in terms of particle physics. Because in particle physics, we have two types of masses. We have the mass of the nucleon and the mass of the electron. And both come from different sources. And one could suspect, perhaps, as people have done, in fact, that perhaps the principle of equivalence is slightly broken on that level, but it doesn't seem to be. And on the other hand, there is this other problem in general relativity, which still is sort of around and will be around for a long time, I think, that on the one hand, in Einstein's relativity, there is the curvature of space-time, continuous notion. On the other hand, matter is given in terms of quantum fields, in terms of particles, in a quantized version. And Einstein's equation, which relates the curvature of space-time in terms of the Riemann tensor, we cannot be quantized. In other words, we can only assume this is equal to the classical expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, which includes the mass, of course. And but nevertheless, even if people haven't solved this kind of quantization, my colleague in Munich, Julius Bess, tries to do that, for example, by quantizing space and time. Well, I wish him good luck for that. But anyway, it calls for a unified concept of mass. And that means that the principles of what we see from the masses in quantum chromodynamics, in the strong interaction physics, and the mass generation for the electron must somehow be related. And I will come back to this issue later on. Let me also, in terms of this general introduction, just mention, this is well known also to everyone, as Max Planck already realized at the beginning of our last century, that the gravity constant itself, combined with quantum physics, defines already a mass scale, which is probably the most basic mass scale in physics. Unfortunately, it's very big, 10 to the 19 GeV, or 10 to minus 8 kilogram. It's about 50 bacteria, about or just about 1/50 of the mass of a bacterium, or 0.02 milligram. And that also defines the usual lengths and time quantities, the Planck units. Well, if you ask yourself, what would be the ultimate goal, at what point can we close the books of physics? Well, it would be the goal if we express everything, all the masses, in terms of that fundamental quantity, expressing the mass of the electron of 0.5 MeV in terms of the Planck constant, and that, of course, will not be so easy, and perhaps will never be achieved. But this would be the ultimate goal. Now, before I turn to the mysteries and the partial resolutions of that mystery for the lepton and quark masses, let me point out another well-known feature. You can show that here. That is related to the mass of the nucleon. The mass of the nucleon was a mystery for many years. In fact, when I was a starting PhD student, end of the 60s, still with one of the latest of Werner Heisenberg, Heisenberg was telling me, the nucleon mass is the most essential thing to understand in physics. And by now we understand it in a very simple way. It's somehow a miracle of QCD. As you well know, in particular David knows it very well, the Coupling constant at QCD goes down at high energies. And usually people nowadays, after the position measurements at lab, they define the strong interaction coupling constant at a particular energy scale, like the mass of the C0, 91 GeV. And it seems to be rather precisely 0.12, 0.125 to be more precise. But anyway, this is around 1/8, 0.12. And the connection between the energy scale where you define the coupling constant according to the principle of the renormalization group somehow makes a connection between a dimensionless quantity, usually the alpha strong, and the coupling constant for strong interaction physics, the quark-gluon coupling constant, and the mass scale where it is defined. In some fancy words, this is usually called dimensional transmutation. And Sidney Coleman introduced this nice slogan, which I like, that somehow there is a mass scale produced out of nowhere, in other words, from no mass from no mass. Well, from that principle, we understand now the nucleon mass by interesting trick or interesting combination of asymptotic freedom and confinement of QCD. And you have a little picture explaining that. And if you look at a quark, as you know, in an electron, if you come close to an electron, the charge increases according to the uncertainty relations and quantum electrodynamics. But if you look at quarks, the things are opposite due to the coupling of the gluons to themselves. And if you start out in the center, the coupling constant is rather small, and it eventually reaches a rather large value, and formally it explodes. And the point of formal explosion, this is not a real explosion, but just a formal thing, which happens in the lowest order calculation. This defines a mass scale, which one could call the Landau pole of QCD, and that happens at a particular energy scale, measured to be rather precisely 150 MeV, usually called lambda. But the inverse of it is nothing but the basic scale of nuclear physics, the one Fermi scale of nuclear physics, 10⁻¹³ cm. And that also explains, of course, why quarks are permanently confined, because formally the mass is infinite. But based on that notion, we have a rather precise picture of the nucleon mass, although the numbers are still fluctuating. Namely, the 940 MeV of the nucleon mass, or if you like, 1.6 × 10⁻²⁷ kilogram, is nothing but the field energy density which of the quarks and gluons in a finite volume, given by the radius of the chromodynamic interaction. And if you want to be more precise, about 70% of the nucleon mass is given by the gluonic field energy density, and about 30% by the quark field energy density. These numbers are subject to at least 10% uncertainties, mostly obtained here from I got these numbers from Okun in Moscow, who based it on the QCD sum rules. But there are other ways to do that, but we come to the same conclusion. So in other words, we understand somehow, one could say we have a full understanding of the nucleon mass, although we will never be able to calculate the mass of a complicated, strongly interacting system. Let's say even the mass of the helium nucleus cannot be calculated from first principles. But that's good enough for that purpose. So mass is confined field energy, and it's related to a finite extension. In other words, the finite size of the nucleon defines the mass of the nucleon. And that is an interesting thought in itself, because first of all, as I said, from gravity and from the fact that the equivalence principle works so well, and gravity is affected by the nuclear masses generated in this way, we would have to conclude that this principle perhaps should also be applied in a different way, nevertheless, but in a similar way at least, also to the lepton and quark masses. If you take it seriously, it would eventually go into the direction that the quarks and also the electrons eventually have a finite radius. But I will come back to this issue. But anyway, the gravity field of a neutron star is essentially due, not completely, but 99% due to this mechanism. And what is surprising in particle physics is simply the fact that we have a different way of generating masses, namely the way the W and Z naught masses are generated, and also the way the lepton and quark masses are generated. Well, I will not speak, this is all at least known to most of you, how these masses are generated. This is just the usual mechanism by Higgs and collaborators, not collaborators, but colleagues, Proud, Englert, Kippel, and Higgs. Where you have a specific Higgs field to do that, and I will not talk about this anymore. This is a mechanism, the W comes along, interacts with a Higgs field which is jumping out of a vacuum, and it has a finite vacuum expectation value which defines the mass scale, and that way the masses of the W and the node are generated. And all what is known from the lab experiments, in particular at CERN, this works extremely well. Even the most recent data, which were just produced 2 weeks ago at La Chile, at the meeting where I just came from in in the Italian Alps, it works extremely well. The expectation is that the mass for the Higgs particle should be somehow between roughly 100 and 800 GeV. The present limit is also disturbing, which was obtained just in the last few weeks. Namely, it must be larger than 109 GeV, which becomes a certain problem already for the theoretical model, but I will not discuss this issue at all. Just like to mention it. So let me turn now to the problem of the lepton and quark masses. If the Higgs particle really exists the way, I don't think it will exist in the canonical way, but if it exists, like just to show this picture, this is what people are supposed to see in the year 2005 at the Geneva accelerator, a Higgs decaying into two C knots, one making a muon pair, the other one making a muon pair, and the mass is something. Well, we will see. So the issue of lepton and quark masses, everybody believes that this is somehow related to the fact that we have the flavor axis. We have three generations of leptons and quarks. We have three different leptons, electron, muon, and tau, each bringing along its full family of quarks. And the horizontal axis in that scheme is well known. This is the strong interaction axis used for strong interaction purposes. The vertical one is used for weak interaction purposes. And the third one, the flavor axis, is presumably the one which has to be used for all the things we still don't understand, including the mass problem. And I try to show you, or give you an example, how one could get some information about that. Because we have these three families, there is a huge number, this is also well known, a huge number, unfortunately, of fundamental constants in nature, in the so-called standard model. A word I never liked. It was invented by Shelley Clerscher, but I don't like this word standard model. Anyway, you can arrange the things in such a way, some sort of magic circle in the middle of Newton's constant, accompanied by the fine structure constant alpha. But all the other constants you see here, in particular the green and the green belt around it, are the eigenvalues of the masses, which are completely mysterious so far, I mean, not really explained. And so out of the 18 parameters of the standard model, this is a rather conservative counting. We could have more, but let's say 18. 15 of them are really related to the masses, including the QCD scale parameter for the nucleon mass, including the W mass, including certain mixing parameters in the weak interaction sector, which I will concentrate on in a few minutes, altogether 15. So it's obvious that the main sort of, if you want to attach or attack the problem of masses, you have to discuss all these 15 parameters. I should also say, I will remark about it, that if neutrinos are massive, which seems to come sort of along from the new experiments, there will be at least 7 more parameters, presumably even more, presumably or 10, perhaps even 12 or 13, depends on what kind of model you take. For the neutrino sector. Well, one should be very careful in applying the standard model to the lepton and quark masses. The problem is that the basic mass scale for weak interactions is a mass scale of 200, essentially 250 GeV, and that defines also the masses for the W and the Z naught. And we have invented some sort of vehicle that generates the masses for the leptons, which is something I never really believed. But this consists of introducing a special coupling constant of the fermion fields to the Higgs field. And so the big mass scale in the Higgs sector, 250 GeV, defines really the masses for the leptons and quarks. And as a result, for the leptons, for the electrons, for example, you have to introduce a very small coupling constant. This would be sort of in a natural way to generate also the mass for the top quark mass, but it's certainly not very good for the electron mass. Well, in the standard model, there is really no simple way to obtain any regularities. That's what we are driving at. And I'd like to mention one thing here. Years ago when Murray Gell-Mann had his 60th birthday, I was supposed to give a talk here, and then he asked me I should give a talk about the generation of the electron mass and some models for that. Of course, I couldn't find an explanation that was obvious. But when I prepared my talk in Caltech in those days, I finally tried to express the electron mass in all sorts of funny units, and I found accidentally that the 0.511 MeV, if you express them in terms of an interesting unit, namely of American pounds, it's an integer. It's exactly 2.000 times 10 to the minus 30, and I couldn't believe when I put it in my little HP calculator. And since, in particular, coming from Europe, for me the American pound is always a mysterious quantity, but it works very well. And in fact, some 2 or 3 years ago, I needed to know the pound. I was somewhere here in the States. And then I couldn't find it out, so I took my Schoen booklet, took the electron mass, and I knew this ratio, and so I had it. That's something useful to keep in mind if you ever want to express the American pound in terms of kilogram. Because in the Schoen booklet, you have the electron mass in kilogram. And if you know that, you have it in pound. So Nick Samios, the director of Brookhaven, was at that talk in Caltech, and he told me later on, he gave that information on to his friend, Sam Nunn, one of the influential senators, actually the guy who eventually was influential in killing the SSC project. And Nunn was very excited about it, and he brought it up in the Senate when they had a discussion about adopting the European units or not. And he used it as an argument to... well, you know, it was very dangerous. So coming back to the lepton and quark masses, I like to, for those of you who are not in particle physics, like to point out the electron mass is somehow also a strange accident. What we really see is a huge, most of the masses on the top quark, which is after all something like 175 GeV, a huge tower. And also the other, the partners of the third family, the bottom quark and the tau, are relatively heavy. The others are very light. Here I give some typical values for these masses. They are a little bit disputed, but the most reliable work in that respect has been done by the group in Bern in Switzerland. The speeds are usually very precise, these things. And so I took the values of Leutwiller here for that. And they are normalized. Quark masses are, since quarks are confined, you have to, like the coupling constant of strong interaction physics, you have to indicate a certain scale. And here I used simply the top quark mass as a corresponding scale. You can also use a C0, it doesn't change very much. And these are the corresponding values. For the leptons, of course, you don't have this problem. You simply take the observed lepton values. And, well, if you look at the spectrum, then you see, first of all, this huge dominance of the third family, the top quark, the bottom and the tau. But you also observe something else I'd like to point out, because it's still a little bit of a mystery. There is some sort of fractal structure in the eigenvalues, in the sense that if you plot these values on a logarithmic scale, they are essentially straight lines for the quarks. For the charged leptons, unfortunately, it doesn't work so well. Well, actually, it doesn't work at all for the electron. The electron is a little bit too light. But yeah, well, if there is a pointer somewhere.
Behind you.
Behind me? Yeah. Oh, yeah, the big one. It's a little too... it's essentially a rather a straight line. And in particular, if you use the best values you can get at the moment, it's really a straight line. It simply means that the ratios, top to charm and charm to up, is the same. These two numbers are the same, and the same B to S and S to D. And I used many years ago this idea when the top quark was still not clear. I mean, it was not seen. I used once in a colloquium in Caltech, I used such a plot just an example in order to get an idea about the top quark mass. I took that thing, and I arrived at a mass around 160, 155, 170 GeV or so, which turned out to be correct. Nobody believed it at that time. And it was still 1 year before Feynman died. And Feynman was sitting in the first row in this colloquium in Caltech. And he was shaking his head. And he said, you know, then he asked me the question, how precise that number is. And then he was still shaking his head. And then he said, well, look, on a logarithmic plot, even Sophia Loren looks like a straight line. And
well,
yes. You mean that maybe the leptons take properties from both? Well, people have played, in fact, Koide in Japan has played with such an idea. It works so far okay. But I mention that because this is, I will explain in a few minutes that some of the things I understand, but this is still not understood. It looks a little bit like in the old days where people plotted the hadrons on a mass square plot, the usual ratchet trajectories, which also turned out to be straight lines. But it's an interesting feature. But what I will do is now try to make clear that there is some definite pattern for the quark mass in the quark mass sector related to the flavor mixing. For those who are not very familiar with that, let me just point out that the basic weak interaction, means always a connection, a decay or interaction between the upper and the lower sector for the quarks. The W boson simply takes the top quark into the B, charm into strange, and U to D. So, and the main factor or the main effect of the weak interaction is within the same family. But unfortunately, or fortunately, we see a sort of a crosstalk between these various families, and the largest communication is between the first and the second family, usually described by the Khabibo angle, which is relatively large, something like 1/5. That gives a number in a minute, while the other connection is very small. And that is usually described by indicating how the weak interaction partners of the up and the C and the top quark react in the weak interaction. And that means you have to write down the mass eigenstates and make a unitary transformation of those. And that is usually a 3x3 unitary matrix introduced first by Kobayashi and Maskawa many years ago. And it is phenomenologically, it is almost a unit matrix. Let me give you some of the recent numbers. Well, they haven't changed in the last 2 years. These are the numbers we see. And I'd like to point out in particular that the transition between the U quark and the strange quark is very precisely known. I will use that fact later on. It's 2 per mil. U to B is already much less well known, of course. Charm to bottom is known for many years. What came up recently, and more recently in the last 2 years, or 3 years, let's say, is also information about the connection between the top quark and the down quark, and top quark and strange. And these things cannot be seen directly. They have been seen indirectly because of the transitions of B mesons, where the top quark appears as a virtual particle. This can never be seen directly in the experiment. But the numbers have become rather precise, and since I will make a prediction about that number in a few minutes, I'd like to point out that this is by now rather well known. Anyway, these numbers are essentially fundamental parameters, just like the masses, like the electron mass or the muon mass. So any deeper understanding of any of these numbers is certainly welcome in this respect. And I should also say, this I forgot to mention before, when I showed you this magic circle here. If you look at this magic circle of fundamental constants, there are various ways to interpret them. The most conservative one is simply to adopt these numbers and say, well, that's it. That would mean giving up, essentially, understanding these numbers. Another possibility is that eventually they can be calculated in some higher theory. Well, we have to postpone that for a long time. Some point of view is the one which sometimes is not always, but sometimes is defended by Gell-Mann, who calls these things frozen accidents. The idea behind this is the following, that right after the Big Bang, all these numbers were allowed to fluctuate. And when the universe cools down below a certain critical temperature, then accidentally these numbers just take a certain value. That's possible, and that would mean, however, that we will never be calculate the thing. It would also mean if you would repeat the Big Bang, then these numbers would be different. Well, whatever things go, there is one interesting possibility, namely that at least there are certain connections between these parameters. Since we see these hierarchies, it really calls for some sort of a symmetry or some sort of a underlying structure. So it's not us, it doesn't seem to be arbitrary. And so what I will try to explain to you that we actually can discuss such symmetries, and they seem to make reasonable predictions for the experiments. That would simply mean that even if Gell-Mann is right and there are such frozen accidents, that there are simply connections among these parameters. And if they fluctuate, then the connections are still preserved. And so the question is, what are these connections? Well, one possibility, which I was studying for quite some time, is the following. The rather simple idea that the third family is very heavy. Top quark, bottom quark, and tau lepton are heavy. And so on a linear scale, we normalize them to one. And let's look at the top quark, for example. The top quark has the charm quark and the up quark as a partner. Now, these quarks are extremely light compared to the top. We can essentially neglect them. It's a 2% change. 98% of the mass is in the top quark channel. And if you throw away these 2% and make it 100%, that simply means that you bring down these values to zero. Well, that would be a 2% change. It's like going to the isospin limit in nuclear physics. It's not a big thing to do. But if you do that, you get an interesting insight. Namely, you have two masses which are massless at this point of view, in that limit, and one is massive. And it looks like a sort of a mass gap generation. People are used to such things in solid state physics from superconductivity, for example. And that thing, this possibility has been discussed by a lot of people. First, I think by Nambu, then I was one of them, and a lot of people were involved in specific models of this type. Also, I think you have at some point worked on this. I will describe a rather specific point of view, namely the following. If two eigenvalues are zero, the first two families are massless, and the third one is the one which is heavy, I mean, has a mass, this is a rank one mass matrix and can easily be brought in a different form. Everybody knows such a mass matrix, if you make a suitable rotation, can be brought into a form in which all the elements are equal. And if you diagonalize that, of course, you get back the old one. That means if you have here we have a 100% hierarchy, a very strong mass hierarchy. On the other hand, here we have all the elements are equal, and you can make changes of these elements without changing the physics or changing the structure of the matrix. And for that reason, this is called a democratic mass matrix, a name invented by Cecilia Jarlskog. She's from Sweden, and Sweden is, of course, a democratic country. And but it's interesting that you go from a democratic situation to a hierarchical situation simply by a unitary transformation. Interesting thought. Again, we gave some years ago, I won a colloquium in Beijing, and I mentioned this also, that by a unitary transformation, you can go from here to here. And the students got an interesting idea. They asked me about how to do that. And I had some problem with that afterwards. Was at Beijing University, which is an interesting place. That's the place, a small university, the elite university in Beijing, where usually the political trouble starts in China. Anyway, sometimes I call this subnuclear democracy, this possibility. Now, what do you gain with that? This seems to be rather trivial, but what you gain is the following. That here, from this point of view, going from here to here is like going from a geocentric to a heliocentric worldview. And of course, this is the same in Einstein's view. They are completely equivalent. But here you see a symmetry which you would not see here, namely simply the possibility of interchanging all the columns and rows. In other words, so there is a discrete symmetry S3 times S3. And this is the symmetry I'm going to use. Some people also use bigger symmetries, like, for example, embedding that group in the SU3 group, for example. So quite a number of models of this type. What I will do is simply following the simplest route and try to convince you that is something interesting to consider. For those of you who are used to particle physics, I should say that in high energy physics, we already went once through this procedure, where people had observed that there is at least in the chiral symmetry limit, a massless pion and a massless eta meson, and all of a sudden a massive eta prime. That was a puzzle for many years until it was realized that this can be understood in a very simple way. Here is the explanation. And it's an explanation which goes down deep into the property of quantum chromodynamics. Namely, if you have a mass matrix like that, you also can bring it down to a democratic form. But then what you do is essentially you go introduce the quark states, the quark bilinears, U by U, D by D, and S by S. So in a way, people could have invented already, people like Nambu around 1960, when they looked at this property, could have invented the quarks. And the point is, from this point of view, what happens is that you see you between all the various states there are very strong transitions, and they are indeed they are there in QCD. A U by U configuration goes via a gluonic system into a D by D and S by S, and this is all the same because of the universality of QCD. This is all universal. And as a result, the pi and the eta prime wave function can be described in terms of the quark wave function in a very simple way. As you see, the eta prime is just this coherent superposition of all the three things. And this is similar to what happens in superconductivity. A superconductor is nothing but a big matrix of this type, and the interaction among the Cooper pairs is all universal. And because it's universal, it's superconducting. If it would not be universal, then you simply don't get a superconductor. And here, except here, I mean, you have only three states, so it's, to call it a superconductor is a little bit too much. But the main thing is you have these transitions, and it was a mystery for many years why these transitions are so big. And now we understand it in QCD. Well, not completely fully, but it was pointed out by Boyakov, Turf, and also by David Gross, and others that you have these very strong transitions caused by instantons in QCD. And the same effect does not appear for the vector mesons, by the way. It's only a particular channel in strong interaction physics, the zero minus plus channel, where this effect is there. So we have some sort of a guiding model for this for a situation like that. So all what you need, if you have the three families and you see this strong mass hierarchy, all what you need is just three states, and then you have to invent strong transitions among the three, just like you did with the gluonic transitions among the quark states, and then you get the heavy top quark mass, and you get the other things brought down to zero in mass. The question is whether what does it mean really in terms of mass generation for the leptons in particle physics. In the standard model, this is already the case, because in the standard model, obviously, we can introduce the top quark the way it is, and you get these rather strong transitions among these three states simply by the Higgs particle. But you can think of many other models to do that, and so the Higgs possibility is just one out of many. Let me just write down again this dictionary between the democratic state and the hierarchical situation. This matrix is simply given by the square root of 3, square root of 2, the very simple transition. It gives you simply, also in strong interaction physics, between the wave functions of the pi naught, the eta and eta prime, makes the transition to u by u, d by d, and s by s. It's the same matrix. And that matrix should be kept in mind because I think it's a very interesting matrix. We come back at the end to the neutrino situation where all the same thing should also describe the oscillations of neutrinos. And here already I give you the wave functions for the leptons based on that. If you go to the limit where the first two families are massless, then we have here the situation with the massive tau. Go to the democratic situation. Since I have that symmetry, I can introduce simply from group theory the eigenstates of that symmetry, and I call it L1, L2, and L3, L for lepton. And as a result, the electron, muon, and tau are these simple wave functions, completely the same as for the pi 0, eta, and eta prime in the limit of chirosymmetry where the pi 0 is massless. Here is a little picture for that. This is, as you see, the electron is a superposition with a 45-degree mixing angle. Two colors. The muon has three colors. The yellow color is the third one, which is dominating, and the blue and the green. And the tau is a particularly nice state. It has all the three together. All the three is a coherent state in the language of of the BCS theory of superconductivity. The tau is a superconducting object in that language. And it has an equal mixture. As you see, it looks like a Mercedes star. It has all the three colors with the same symmetry. The electron has only two colors, so it's like a BMW. Since I come from Munich, and I should make some advertisement for the German cars. these are the structures. Well, if you have such a symmetry, and it's not simply an accident, I mean, the symmetry is there. It's definitely there, simply because of the hierarchy. The question is only whether the symmetry has a physical meaning. Well, usually we decide this question by discussing the symmetry breaking. And if you, again, we use sort of nature as a guide. And if we are in the limit of S3 symmetry, the electron and the muon, I forgot here to write equal to zero, all the first two elements are equal to zero, U and charm equal to zero, down and strange equal to zero. But then we go to the next step where the mass for the second family is introduced. In other words, muon, charm, and strange are getting a mass, as they should be. These are the heavier objects. But the electron, the up quarks and down quarks are still massless. And eventually, then everything is broken. Well, this can easily be achieved by going from an S3 group down to S2. S2 is very simple. It's just a reflection group of two elements. And so and the picture looks like that. At the beginning, the first two families are massless. Then there's this mass splitting. The second one gets a mass. And eventually, everybody gets a mass. Well, if you use this symmetry, there's one interesting consequence. Namely, in the absence of the masses for the second and the first family, one can easily see, it's also intuitively clear, that the CKM mixing matrix for the weak interactions should be trivial. It should be the unit matrix. And because massless states, in general, should not mix with heavier states, that would violate the underlying symmetry, in particular also the chiral symmetry. So we start out from the CKM matrix to be the unit matrix. And then the physical CKM mixing matrix should evolve simply once the other masses are introduced. This is the principle. And it calls for a hierarchy of these elements. This is precisely the hierarchy we also seem to see. And but before I discuss a specific hierarchy, let me point out something which was found only recently and has been adopted now by the particle data group people in Berkeley. That's the following observation. As I just said, if the second family is equal to zero and the up quark and the down quark are also zero, you should have the unit matrix to start with. Then I introduce only the mass for the second. If you introduce the mass for the second quark, what should happen for the CKM mixing matrix, independent now of the specific models, with the general feature, there should only be a mixing between the second and the third family. In other words, and such a mixing is simply described by one angle, by just one rotation matrix. So it's coming in here. Then, since I have this underlying model in mind, I now can make some sort of a Gedanken experiment and introduce only the mass for the down and not the mass for the U. Can also go the other way. But let's first do it for the down. Well, if you do it for the down quark, once a down quark gets a mass, it's going to mix with a strange quark because of it, since it's getting a mass. And therefore, there should be on the right-hand side a little rotation matrix connecting down and strange. So it's the green matrix. The other one is the one connecting the second with the third family. And at the final step, we do the same thing with the up quark, and that's what you get. Well, that looks rather simple. And you see that way of evolution of the CKM mixing matrix has an interesting physical picture in a sense that you can read off. All these angles can be measured from the experiments. That this green angle simply describes you how strongly the mixing appears between down and strange. And here the mixing between U and C. This is the yellow one. And by the way, since eventually we have to have a complex phase, that complex phase comes in right at this point when the mass for the U quark is introduced. It's coming in here, and the convenient location is simply up here. But you can also put it somewhere else. But what I just showed you is something which was surprising to me from the point of view. When I saw it about 3 years ago, I was in sabbatical in Japan, because I had seen such a pattern before for completely different reason. Namely, if you work out, if you multiply all these three rotation matrix, well, first of all, you notice what you just have seen here is a mixing matrix which was introduced by Leonhard Euler more than 200 years ago. What is it? It's an XY rotation, it's a YZ rotation, XY rotation. That's what people usually learn as the Euler rotation in classical mechanics. And the only difference to Euler's is the complex phase over here, which you need and which is important for CP violation. And if you multiply it out, you get a structure like that. First of all, the beta decay, which is this is the element for beta decay. It has a complex phase, but this is no problem. The main what is measured in the experiment is simply the absolute value. And this is one. The interesting feature is that the Kabibu element is a superposition of two terms with a phase. Another interesting feature is that the element for the UB, this is the transition element from the up quark to the bottom quark, is a product of two angles. By the way, SU means simply the sine of that angle, theta sub U. S itself without any index means the sine of this angle, and this is the angle S sub D that appears here. So if you take the ratio between those two elements, both are experimentally measured, you simply get the angle S sub U. Now what's interesting here is that such a matrix indirectly was obtained by everyone who was, also Tony Z was one of them, who worked in terms of looking at trying to generate these patterns or these the mixing parameters from grand unified theories. If you do that, you always get such a pattern that the Kabibu angle in particular is the sum of two terms. And it was not realized, however, that this is an actual valid representation of the experimental situation. And I convinced only recently that Fred Gilman, who is doing that, that should be done, and in the next edition of the particle data group thing that will be introduced and used. indirectly, you got it already. To a certain extent, it was already in my old paper in 79, and also Forgaard and Nielsen, almost has disappeared because I wrote it recently in green. Forgaard and Nielsen in their paper had it indirectly, also Dimopoulos, Hall, and Raby, and others. And only in 97 it was finally realized that this should be done in general, and it would give you a direct information about the strength of the mixing. unfortunately, the standard way of describing the flavor mixing, which is still used by now by the experimentalists, does not go this way. And therefore, what happens is that the standard way of doing it doesn't have this mass hierarchy pattern. But the interesting thing here, maybe I'll show it again, the interesting thing is that you can turn off the masses. If you take away the up quark mass, you take off this. If you take away the down quark mass, take that. And eventually, it takes the mass of the second generation away, and then you come down to the unit matrix. So it's a rather simple way of describing things. And what would be the conclusion for the experimentalists? Well, if you take this mixing matrix, this is the one in lowest order, what you do is for the following. You take this ratio VUB over VCB, usually measured by the experimentalists, and this is precisely the sine of this one angle. VTD over VTS is the other angle. So we have a way of defining or getting these angles directly from the experiments. And once you have done that, you plot it in here and check and take the absolute value of this element, and you have the Kabibu angle. Well, the consequence is that if you have this structure, that you get, as you see here in the complex plane, you get a triangle. And this triangle is interesting. In fact, to a certain extent, there was a meeting in the Northeastern University already in 1976, before Lederman discovered the bottom quark, before the third family was known. And I discussed such a triangle with Stephen Weinberg. We were wondering what this triangle means. We didn't realize at the time that it essentially describes CP violation. But anyway, this is a triangle. And if you look at it, this is nothing but what is called the unitarity triangle. The unitarity triangle is usually introduced in the standard model in a rather complicated way. Here it comes for free simply by looking at the Kabibu element. And it's not precisely the unitary triangle, it's rescaled. But if you multiply a triangle, all the sides with the same factor, you don't change the structure of the triangle, you don't change the angles. So this is experimental known, this is experimentally known, this is known experimentally. So in principle, you could work out, the least you could do is work out this phase. So this is one consequence, first of all. So you see the light quarks, this is all a property of the light quarks. The up-down, the charms range system has nothing to do with the third generation. And it's the light quark situation which defines the structure of this triangle and which defines CP violation. That's one step. The second interesting step is the following, that if you ask yourself, what is the simplest way of breaking the symmetry S3 down to S2 and eventually down to anything? You come out with a conclusion that the tangent of the first angle is given by square root of mu over mc. That these are exact relations. The tangent of the second angle is square root of md over ms. And this is in turn, of course, related to these ratios for the observed element. And the third conclusion is that the angle phi, the phase angle which appears in this triangle, here I show the triangle again. This is this angle. that up here, this phase, up in the Khabibov element, that should be 90 degrees. Actually, it's not completely true. It can either be, there are two choices. One is zero. Zero means that the triangle is flat, there's no triangle. And that in turn would mean that there is no CP violation in nature. And the other possibility is 90 degrees. And that immediately implies that CP violation is maximal in the sense that the largest value you could get for this triangle is 90 degrees. So the question is whether that's, how does it look in the experiments? Well, here's again this conclusion for the simplest symmetry breaking. You have this triangle, the square root of md over ms is this side, square root of mu over c is the other side, this is a Khabibov element, known to 1 per mil. And then you see that if you turn off the mass of the u-quark, all what happens is this triangle would go down to zero. If you turn off the mass of the down quark, then the triangle would move down here to zero, and all the CP violation disappears in this limit. And and that also means that the corresponding angles would disappear. And since I said already this is the unitary triangle, seen from a completely different point of view, and in fact it was 76 indeed when Weinberg and myself in Northeastern at that meeting looked at this triangle and calculated these angles, and we didn't know what the angles mean. But now we know this is what is usually called the angle alpha in the usual definition of the unitary triangle. This is the angle gamma, this is the angle beta. Now these angles are measurable quantities, and so what is the expectation? Well, for one thing, since the alpha is equal to 90 degrees, alpha means essentially this phase phi I was saying, which is 90 degrees. So this is a rectangular triangle. Very simple conclusion. If you don't take this result from the simplest symmetry breaking and keep alpha as a free parameter, that's what we did a long time ago, then we found out it can fluctuate between 70 and 110. So 90 degrees is right in the center. But here the expectation is 90 degrees. Well, for a rectangular triangle, then you get some little help by the theoretician Pythagoras. how does it look if you take the squares? So the idea is you take the square of the Khabibov angle, and that should be equal to md over ms and plus mu over mc. Well, if you take the best values given to me by Leutwiler for the mass ratios, he has the best values, I think. The experimental value for the Khabibov, as I said, is up to 1 per mil. It's known. It's 0.223. That's what you get from the theoretical expectation. It's essentially given by this ratio md over ms. So there is a relation which many people have discussed before, also Tony C. at a certain point, Weinberg, myself, many other people, that the square of the Khabibov angle is given by md over ms. It's not completely true here, but it's essentially true because this is only a small correction. And this is what you expect from this is the theoretical value, this is the experimental value, agrees up to the level of about 2 per mil. So it's a very good result. And so when I was back from Chapin in Geneva 1.5 years ago, I asked the people from Delphi, in particular Mr. Stogge and his big group in Paris, to make a complete reanalysis of all what was known, including the lab data, using our parametrization with these three angles and the phase. And I didn't tell him what I expect from the theory. So I gave him simply this representation I was explaining to you before. And he came, after a few weeks, came up with his results. And then I showed him what I would expect, and he was quite surprised. Namely about here, you see the 90 degrees, he gets with also good precision. And the data have become better recently. And all the other angles are now known. This is the expectation from theory. It works quite well. The error here is big, as you see. It's slightly larger than what he gets, but it agrees very well with the expectation. So the 90 degrees essentially means that CP violation is maximal. In the same way as parity violation is maximal, in the standard model in the sense that it acts on a left-handed, for left-handed quarks. And here it simply applies as, for the unitary rectangular triangle, which is the largest steam you could get for CP violation. See, the other conclusion, here is the experimental plot which you find in physics letters recently. Don't look at these numbers in detail, but here you see that this is the precisely pi over 2, 90 degrees. Looks very well. And I'm surprised myself how good it works. But this all will be tested very soon by the new machines, which are just operating, starting to operate at SLAC and over in at DESI and in Tsukuba in Japan. So in 3 years from now, we will have a rather precise measurement of all these parameters, and then we can test whether it really works. Here is another conclusion from the, unfortunately, I repaired that recently when I was at SLAC a few days ago. That doesn't look too good. But this is our rectangular unitary triangle. All these things are well known, and this is 90 degrees. And it is not quite in the center, but of course within the allowed range for the experiments. And we also the other angles can be calculated because the triangle is completely known, so you know the angles. However, subject to the uncertainties given by the people who do the quark mass estimates, beta is between 18 and 22 degrees, and gamma should vary between 70 and 74 degrees, where the angle alpha is precisely 90 degrees. So the sum of the two should better be also 90 degrees. So far, that agrees well with experiments. The experiments from lab, unfortunately, are a little bit, they're around 0.8 with a big error of about 0.2. So it's within the error bars easily, but slightly higher than the expectation, while the experiments from Cornell, which I think are more precise, are more sort of the curve is 0.72 or so. Here for sine 2 beta, 0.70 they find, and this is the upper, sort of the upper value we get. Another remark here about CP violation. Since we everything is known, the so-called Yarskog parameter, which describes CP violation, can be calculated. It's simply given by the square root of masses, the product of the two, times the square of that angle theta, which is the mixing angle between the second and the third generation. What we find is completely d'accord, which is so far what's known from the experiments. But I would like simply to point out a possibility which intrigues me a little bit, that if this angle phi is indeed 90 degrees, as the theory says and as the experiment says at the same time, then it calls for, again, some sort of a reflection symmetry. In other words, this pi over 2 for phi, if you flip it over to minus pi over 2, simply go from I to minus I, it would imply that you this would not agree with experiments anymore. You simply come to a different world, but at least you could discuss such a reflection symmetry. And again, it has two type symmetry. And the sine of this angle has observable consequences because it defines the asymmetry of the decay of the B bar, the anti-B meson compared to the B meson in the shape psi and the K short. That thing is either positive or negative. If you make this flip over, it goes from plus to minus. And according to the experiments, well, they are not very conclusive, but preliminary from Fermilab recently, this seems to be indeed larger than zero. That means phi is indeed plus pi over 2 and not minus pi over 2. The finally, a remark about the situation for the leptons. So for the quarks, it seems to be that the CKM mixing matrix, which is part of the quark mass problem, seems to come out entirely d'accord with the experiments, and future tests will come soon. And if this is really true, what can we say about the leptons? Well, again, I show you these simple wave functions based on the S3 symmetry for the quarks which I was using. Now I apply it for the leptons. Well, there are two ways to do that. If the neutrinos are Fermi Dirac particles, just like the quarks, you would come to the same similar conclusions as here. In other words, we can calculate the mixing matrix for the neutrinos if neutrinos have a certain mass. That would be it. But the CKM matrix would be similar to the unit matrix, not very far different from that. And that would be the solution. It wouldn't agree with any of the experiments, unfortunately. But the other possibility is the following. If neutrinos are Majorana particles, as many people think, well, there's a what's the difference between Fermi-Dirac and Majorana? In the Majorana case, the left-handed particles and the right-handed antiparticles are connected by the mass term. They form one massive object. This could not happen for a quark and not happen for a charged lepton. And suppose this is the case. And suppose then you submit this to this machinery of the underlying S3 symmetry I was discussing for the quarks. What is the conclusion? The conclusion is rather simple. We found that in 95, 96, and later on was also emphasized by Yanagida and Tanimoto and others in Japan. The mass matrix, to start with, if you have a Majorana term, and you have this underlying S3 symmetry, is not the 1-1-1 matrix I had. Remember this democratic mass matrix, which was derived from the similar to the instanton business for the pseudoscalar mesons. Because of the Majorana situation, you could not have transitions which are off-diagonal. The only transition which can appear are diagonal. So in other words, the eigenstates of the symmetry which I had introduced, L1, L2, and L3 for the charged leptons, they can also be introduced for the neutrinos, but in the neutrino sector, these must be the mass eigenstates. Otherwise, you have problems. And as a result, the electron, muon, and tau, to start with, are actually these interesting superpositions which we had seen before also for the pseudoscalar mesons, and they're all given in terms of square roots of 2 and square roots of 3 and square roots of 6. And so what would be the consequence? Here I have to be rather brief because I'm really not supposed to speak about neutrinos, so I'd like just to mention it as a side remark. The electron neutrino, if it's really this superposition, which is like the pi zero in QCD, the electron neutrino, if it propagates out of the sun, it will sort of mix with the muon and the tau, namely just with this superposition here, nu 1 plus nu 2. The other one will drop out. And therefore, the mixing goes on not with the muon or the tau, but with the superposition between the two. But the relevant mixing angle is given by the structure of the electron neutrino, and it's 45 degrees. And that's one conclusion. And the small contribution which we have calculated in our paper on physics letters, the small contribution is mainly 45 degrees. And the other thing would be that the muon neutrino, which starts out to be this strange combination, like the eta in SU3, the muon neutrino would, when it propagates, would turn into the tau neutrino. However, not with 45 degree, but the mixing angle is simply given by the direct product of these two wave functions. And it is 54.7 degrees, which looks funny. It's Argus sine square root of 2/3. This is nothing but the old mixing angle introduced by George Zweig when he invented the quark model, namely the phi mixing angle, the phi omega mixing angle in terms of SU3. And 54.7 instead of 45. And that means sine squared theta for the effective angle for the solar neutrino oscillations is 1. Experiments give 1. The Greeks were rather well with experiments for the so-called large angle solutions of the solar neutrino problem. And the other one is sine squared 2 theta for the atmospheric effect is 0.94. And it's not precisely 1, it's below 1, but it's above 0.9. So experiments give anything between 0.9 and 1. Well, for Fermi-Dirac, you have no, if it's Fermi-Dirac, and on top, there would be no reason why the neutrinos should have a different qualitative mass pattern as the charged lepton. In other words, we have two light neutrinos, or one light, and the second one a little bit heavier, and the third one is rather heavy. Under that assumption, I was doing that. And then you get the same pattern as for the quarks and small mixing angles. But in the point is, by the Majorana case, if these are the mass eigenstates, that is the other conclusion I so far didn't mention, that the neutrinos should be degenerate. In other words, a small 0.1 electron volt, or as you like it, three of them, all the three. And then there are small differences. If they're all the same, then there would be no oscillation effect. But here you get a tiny difference, and that difference is given by the experiments, happens to be 0.10 to minus 7 in delta m squared. the rather small difference, and the difference, and the third one would depart from the first one by 10 to minus 3 electron volt squared. So there is a, the two are essentially degenerate, the third one is heavier, but still on the same scale. So this, it looks, there's no reason why it should, but it looks like SU3, you know, up and down quarks are close to each other, and the strange quark is much heavier. And the qualitative is the same pattern. But to start with, they are almost the same, so small departures. And then you get this structure. The group theory reason why this comes out is simply the fact that if you have a Majorana mass term, you have this S, if it's Fermi Dirac, you have the S3 group for the left-handed multiplied with the one for the right-handed one. But if it's Majorana, it's a connection between left and right, and all what happens is the symmetry is reduced to S3, which is the direct sum of the two. Because according to CP, if you make a left-handed rotation, it must be accompanied by the same, by the right-handed one. And that was also remarked by Tanimoto and Yanagida. And therefore, the irreducible mass term is just a unit matrix. So and then you get this effect. Yeah, that's right. Well, you can, there are some papers about that, you can combine this with a Caesar mechanism, as you can always do by a complicated way. But yeah, you lose certainly the predictions from the simple Caesar model. And here also, we have no way of calculating the mass splitting and the mass eigenvalues. There are some people like Moapato are now trying to see whether just because of high order corrections it could be obtained. But this is the pattern which you would get from the group theory, and it's interesting. We derived this long before the experiments came. That was in 95. And I gave a talk in Totsuka's place in Kamioka, in the middle of the mountains there in Japan, and trying to convince them they should look for these large effects. And in fact, they found it finally. And it's, of course, not clear whether this is really the pattern. But if you look for, if you look for a model where you have large algebraic mixing angles to start with, this is the model one should take. There is no other model which has simple properties. There is another model by Barcher and company where he also has the atmospheric angle to be 45 degrees. The problem is that looks simple in terms of these angles, but doesn't look simple in terms of the mass term. Our model looks very simple in terms of the mass matrix, and then as a result you get this mixing angle of 55 degrees, well, so what? That's what it is. It's nothing but it's the same mixing area as for the eta-eta prime, known for many years. So finally, let me simply come to the conclusions. First, about the quark sector. I said before, if you have these, implement these mass hierarchies, eventually, finally, you should write down the quark flavor mixing in terms of the product of these simple rotation matrices, which is just the Euler matrix. And the CP violation is 90 degrees, that means the up theory is a minus I. And that is coming from this S3 symmetry, in particular the minus I, but in the general representation is coming simply from this mass hierarchy considerations. And independent of the specific model, as I said, this will be taken over, I think, in the future, the experimentalist will take it as a parametrization. This is the one which makes contact with this mass hierarchy. The standard model, which is so far used, doesn't do it, unfortunately. In the simplest symmetry breaking, the mixing angle for the green sector, which is the downstrange mixing angle, is given by the square root of the eigenvalues, same here. And CP violation is maximal, the unitarity triangle is immediately falling from that. Alpha is 90 degrees. Unfortunately, some experimentalists don't like that, because that angle, which will be measured at slack, is given by the decay of the B in the pi pi. And if it's 90 degrees, you wouldn't see anything. There would be no asymmetry. It's a null effect, but what can I do? The 90 degrees is here. Gamma and beta can be calculated in terms of the eigenvalues of the masses and subject to certain experimental uncertainties, but the central values are clear. Sine 2 beta in particular is 0.7 more. And so far in agreement with this experiment, we will see whether that holds up. The Slack people will, in about half a year, or maybe already this in July this year, will give a better value for this. So alpha is 90, beta is 22, and gamma is 68. So the whole triangle is completely fixed. So the flavor mixing is completely pinned down. And that, of course, could be an accident, but it looks to me that there are definite patterns. That means that we're sort of we're moving in the right direction, eventually understanding the total mass spectrum of the quarks and perhaps also of the leptons. There's nearly maximum mixing in the neutrino channel, as I was saying, and that is sort of the core with the Kamiokande experiments. There's no way to accommodate here the Los Alamos experiment. There was somebody at SPAC asking me about that, but simply cannot, it must, either it's wrong or this picture is completely wrong. So finally, just some more philosophical remarks. As you know, in strong interaction physics, things started really with symmetries like Heisenberg's isospin in 1932. Eventually, including also chiral symmetries, it came to the notion of quarks, and then eventually the QCD. Now here we are seeing specific symmetries in the family sector, which seem to be rather simple and seem to agree with experiments. And the question is whether this is also a starting point in solving the, everything we wanted to solve. Well, I don't know how the road will be going. One possibility certainly is that we also arrive at some sort of a new substructure. It's not very popular at the moment, but I wouldn't exclude that, because the mass spectrum as we see it, it seems to be rather dynamical, and it's very hard to think of any kind of model. But it could also be, and I discussed it many times, for example, with Ed Witten, who's going to see in Caltech very soon. And they think if somebody works on superstrings, in the superstring theory, you can bypass this. And if you look at the mass of the mass matrix, I didn't show you the pattern finally, which arises from this thing. But if you take precisely these results, then it means that the mass matrix has a specific pattern. There are certain zeros, picture zero patterns in the mass matrix, which are also specific. And this is something which also can be derived in certain models for superstrings. But then it's related to symmetries at very high energies. The interesting thing, by the way, here about this structure is that the results about these mixing angles are completely energy independent. In other words, that if you translate this to super high energies, up to 10 to the 18 GeV or 19 or 17 GeV, depending on what energy scale you discuss, in some sort of grand unification, this doesn't change. The reason is simply that the eigenvalues of the light quarks are essentially independent of the randomization effect, these angles, these ratios here. So any result which we obtain at the present energies, like at slack, I mean 100 GeV or less, translate all the way up to the high energy mass scale, provided there is nothing in between. So that can also be used, and if superstring theory makes a prediction about that, then this would be also a prediction for the low energy sector, just as well. They do run a little bit, but what happens is here that the good thing about this parametrization, which is again not shared by any other representation, including the one which is used right now by the experimentalists, the good thing is here is that these mixing angles are given by light quark mass ratios, and they essentially do not run. Right? They run at the level of 10 to minus 6. Also, if you go from 100 GeV to 10 to the 17 GeV. The reason is that the coupling in the standard model, the coupling of these fermions to the Higgs is such a very tiny coupling. You have a coupling constant. But what does run is this angle here. This is the angle between the second and the third generation, measured to be about 2.3 degrees right now. I think around 2.3 degrees. And that angle, if you have a model for this is running. And so we separate the things which don't run to the things which run. So the unitarity triangle, which is entirely given in terms of those two, that triangle, you take it at low energies, it goes up to the gravity mass scale and doesn't change. And because the theta drops out here. And that was also the reason, what I said before, that we had discussed this triangle already at the level of two generations. It can be discussed. All what happens is that you, in other words, the third generation, as I say sometimes, is the catalyzer of CP violation, but the algebraic structure of CP violation is all given by that, and this is a feature of the light quarks. So this is the end of this philosophical remark. we could bypass this maybe, and then if you have a complete theory, then eventually you could get this pattern. Eventually we also have to get more, of course. At some point one has to calculate things like the top quark mass in comparison to the bottom quark mass and things like that, which so far I have not touched at all. I'm happy to get these family structures out and these patterns, and first we have to check whether that is correct, and then we can go on. Okay, thanks. That's all. Well, yeah, but he assumed, but the nuclear force, as you well know, they are supposed to be universal under SU2 transformations. There were forces. Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. You mean, are there real particles which perhaps connect the various families? Fermilon-type gauge particles, for example. No, not necessarily. For example, if you take as an underlying group, let's say the SO10 theory, and make a simple structure for the symmetry breaking, then in general you get such patterns. I mean, also Tony knows about that. And oh yeah, yeah. No, this is the key. I would not... I would not claim that this is a theory. It's on the level of seeing patterns. I like to see patterns. I like to see symmetries. I don't think at this level you could argue that there must be new interactions. But these discrete symmetries can be embedded in continuous symmetries. Well, the symmetries come from various sources. I mean, even the old flavor symmetry is a symmetry finally which turned out to be a symmetry which can be derived within QCD. As a result, but it's not, I don't mean color, I mean the Gell-Mann's SU3. And that symmetry has a dynamic explanation in terms of QCD. And on that level, I would see it here too. For example, all what's needed is at the beginning this 1-1-1 structure, I mean the universal structure of the elements, which gives the heavy top quark mass. And then you have the simplest breaking of that symmetry. Now, why you would argue, why Gell-Mann, for example, said he had SU3, then he assumed that the symmetry breaking is broken by an octet. That was the simplest thing, but only in terms of QCD we finally understand it. And so I don't exclude the possibility that a certain theory can explain that. In particular, for example, if all these efforts which are done in the superstring theory, they are looking for patterns for the Yukawa coupling constants, which are related to certain algebraic features of these Calabi-Yau manifolds. I'm told, I never studied that in detail, but such things can easily happen. And then you have a structure of the mass matrix which essentially leads to that. All what you need is a particular pattern for the mass matrix. And I can, the mass matrix structure which follows from that is, I can give it here, I didn't have it in transparency. But you have a heavy term, which is essentially the top quark mass, or the bottom quark mass. Then there is a mixing term here. There is a zero here. In other words, there's no mixing between the third and the first. there is a zero here, and there's another mixing term here, which is either imaginary or real. And here's the corresponding, this is the Hermitian matrix. And here's also some term. That's it. This is the structure which you get if you go to the hierarchy base. And such zeros, these texture zeros, come in certain models. They've been discussed. Kobayashi in Japan has looked at this, for example, and there are some people in string theory. It's not very much you ask for. The main thing is this zero here, which looks here a little bit funny, but in terms of S3 symmetry, it's just the simplest breaking of S3, as was found by T.D. Wu and Harry Lehmann 3 years ago. And so you have, and these, that is the Hermitian conjugate of that zero. So basically, these two zeros, and then you get these relations. So I don't think it's too much to be asked for. And also, if you don't like any of these theories, you simply ask the experiments to describe what kind of mass matrix is suggestive, then you get this, because that element really must be very close to zero because of the fact that the UB transition is so small. And well, not in the simplest version. I mentioned composite as only as one route to go. I don't necessarily defend it. But on the other hand, I mean, patterns like this can be obtained in many theories. If you look at the physical spectrum, the way we see it, all the way from the up quark to the top quark, it really looks like a physical spectrum. And that means it looks like there is some real physics going on. And usually, that could be wrong, but usually the way it went so far, in the last century at least, that it always was related to finally the finite size effect, to a finite structure of these objects. From atoms down to the nucleons, well, maybe the strings, if you but the string scale is so high that they had to imagine that, let's say, the light up quark mass of 5 MeV could be obtained from a string phenomenon at 10 to the 19 GeV. It's at least difficult. Yeah, well, this is science fiction, but all right. Yeah, okay.